Does President Trump's decision to send more troops into Afghanistan represent wisdom or folly? We'll talk about it on The Uprising.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are the uprising. With Scott Cosenza and Tim Donner.
There's not going to be a President Donald Trump.
Hey, a president. Can you believe it?
I love the poorly educated.
The voters have guaranteed themselves slavery, economic disaster.
I can't believe I'm losing to this guy.
You could put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables.
Lordy, I hope there are tapes.
I have never met with Russians.
Putin is continuing to advance into
Korea.
Gee, it's amazing that the Russians have been able to influence four special elections.
This is The Uprising, the podcast of LibertyNation.com. Tim Donner with you this week. Afghanistan, it's something we heard about constantly after 9/11, but not so much in recent months. But we still have around 10,000 troops on the ground there. Donald Trump said he would get us out of Afghanistan, but this week, after consultation with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and his military advisors, the president reversed course and said we'd commit more troops. Meanwhile, Iraq continues to founder. Syria's in the midst of a civil war that's led to a massive refugee crisis, with Europe bearing the brunt of it. This all leads to the bigger question of what exactly are we doing in the Middle East in general and Afghanistan in particular? Is there no end in sight to U.S. involvement in this hotbed of radicalism and terrorism and despotism? We're joined by Nathan Steelwater, military affairs correspondent for LibertyNation.com. Hello, Nathan.
Hey, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Well, I appreciate it. So is it clear to you that 4,000 is the number of new troops being committed to Afghanistan? I mean, the president refused to divulge the number in his speech on Tuesday, but it has been widely reported as 4,000.
Well, the president very characteristically didn't really divulge super detailed examples of what exactly he's going to do. That's one thing that he's repeated over and over. The 4,000 number has been floated around. It was requested around that number was requested by some of the top generals in Afghanistan, and a quote unquote Trump administration official told some media folks that this 4,000 number would be happening. So while it's not definitive, it's fairly safe to say that at least 4,000 will probably happen.
Okay. Well, you've been active duty military. Is this troop surge, in your opinion, likely to make a real difference on the ground in Afghanistan?
Well, I think it really depends on specifically what you're saying your mission is. Now, part of the request for more troops that the commanders of Afghanistan have reasoned is that we're kind of in a stalemate right now. The Taliban currently holds more territory than they did after we did the initial invasion in 9/11. Our progress has regressed. So there's definitely something that could be said to anything will help at this point. But really, whether or not those 4,000 troops will make a difference depends on what exactly our victory looks like, comes out to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, our initial invasion of Afghanistan after 9/11 did topple the Taliban regime, although they have regained strength, as you just discussed. But we don't seem to have gained a whole lot of ground since then, and 2,500 American troops have died in Afghanistan. Is this commitment of more troops throwing good money after bad, as the likes of Senator Rand Paul have said since the president's speech?
So again, it really depends on what your metrics for success are. If the metrics for success are we get rid of the Taliban, we're not really doing a great job in that, in so much as, you know, 258 of the districts in Afghanistan are run by the government, 16 of which are controlled by insurgents, and 120 are currently contested. The Taliban and their allies currently hold more territory than they did when we first Afghanistan and put a hurting on them. But again, whether it's good money after bad, that really depends on what the administration decides their metrics for success are, and whether or not just jumping out is the right course of action, at which point those 2,500 lives may be all for naught, or whether they have a more nuanced strategy that we just don't know about yet.
Well, winning has always been the watchword for Donald Trump. He's talked about during the campaign, he said, we're going to be doing so much winning that you're going to be tired of winning. You're going to say, please, no more winning, Mr. President. Well, now he's the president, and we don't have any victories in the Middle East to show for it. Of course, he's only 7 months into his term. But as best you can surmise it, and surmise being the key word, what does this president consider winning? What does he consider victory, do you think, in Afghanistan? Or what would he call victory in Afghanistan?
So again, he hasn't really specified, and part of that goes to his hesitancy to reveal any specific details of strategy. And this is a departure from the Obama administration, which had a more time-based approach. And that's one of the things that President Trump has specifically said, that we're going to move towards a more conditions-based approach than a time-based approach. One thing that he did specify is that we're looking to stop the reemergence of safe havens that would allow terrorists to, you know, attack America from those positions and train and whatnot. So if that is what he's measuring as success, then we're looking at kind of buttressing up the Afghanistan government's ability to do their own counterinsurgency. You know, half the things that we're talking about, we're saying, well, we're killing terrorists, we're not nation building, we want to keep America safe from terrorists. When it comes to Afghanistan, you're talking about counterinsurgency. And counterinsurgency is a long and complicated business. And if you're not doing it with 100% effort, you're going to have the stalemate that we now have in Afghanistan.
Well, and this is not an action, the continuing action in Afghanistan that is widely supported by the American people. I mean, I would think that the political consideration of such a lack of support would have to play into the decisions of both the president and maybe even his chief military advisors and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Yes.
So I think the hair split that we need to make is between the president and the Joint Chiefs. Obviously, the Joint Chiefs are going to be making decisions based on strategic goals, but it's going to be based on what the president's policy is. And that's part of that civil-military relationship that I've discussed in previous articles. But when you look at the strategic goals and decisions and policy decisions that a president makes, in so much as how it deals with public opinion, it really depends on the individual goals and aspirations of that president.
Now, Nathan, there's a tendency for people to conflate Afghanistan into the same thing as Iraq, perhaps because they're both Muslim nations. But the situations are very different. Explain, if you would, where things stand in Afghanistan and where they stand in Iraq.
Afghanistan, you know, had the Taliban and the tribal governments. Afghanistan has always been incredibly tribal. So trying to institute a Western-style government into that situation is going to be incredibly difficult. So when we look at the situations, and I talked about the situation in Afghanistan, specifically the Taliban having more control than they previously did, we're pretty much in a stalemate. You know, unfortunately with Afghanistan, we've had a lot of what's called mission creep, where we never really defined what exactly winning was for Afghanistan. And we kind of had to figure that out as we went along. And unfortunately, that led to, well, we're not going to nation build. Well, we are going to nation build. Well, we're going to get the Northern Alliance to do stuff. Well, we're going to support the Afghan government. Well, you know, we're going to do this. We're going to do that. And unfortunately, that has led to billions of dollars in wasted money on the part of the taxpayer. And fraud, waste, and abuse in the Pentagon is one of the things that I've covered extensively on Liberty Nation. Iraq, on the other hand, you know, we did pull out of Iraq quite considerably. Interestingly enough, when we're talking about not revealing our strategy, the Pentagon, as of March, has pretty much ceased announcing how many troops we have in Iraq. That's one thing that the Obama administration, you know, maintained. They wanted to be transparent and whatnot. Under the Trump administration, the Pentagon is mum about who all we've got there. So we can estimate troop numbers. And around March, it was estimated we had about 6,000. They're mostly in an advisory role. You know, the government in Iraq is
for all its faults, generally more stable and a little more organized than the one in Afghanistan. And that's part of that tribal versus not tribal difference between the two countries. The Iraqi government lost a lot of ground to ISIL slash ISIS, whatever you want to call them, in early 2014. They've made a lot of successes recently. Recently recaptured Mosul. They've started the Tal Afar offensive, I believe, which is some of the area around Mosul. So the Kurds pretty much control the northeastern third to quarter of Iraq. The government owns a large portion of the country, and it's mostly kind of that western segment that borders Syria that ISIL still controls. Afghanistan, more of the rural areas are controlled by the Taliban, and you actually have a couple of ISIS allies that do have some small areas of control, mostly near the Pakistan border. But the situations are very different because we're seeing an Iraqi government that's finally getting their act together and with American support and assistance is able to kind of figure it out and start to make some headway against ISIS.
Well, now let's dig a little deeper into Iraq with a sort of fundamental question. And that is whether things are actually any better there now than they, or are they worse? Or are they essentially the same from the time we overthrew Saddam Hussein? In other words, is Iraq more stable? Is it less of a threat than it was before we went in and took out Saddam and engaged in this years-long war?
So obviously the fact that ISIS exists and owns territory in Iraq would categorically say that it's worse off. If we're going to talk about compared to before we toppled Hussein versus after we toppled Hussein, you know, the one good thing about dictatorships is that their governments are relatively stable. That's the one benefit.
Right.
And I use the term very loosely. That's the one benefit that an iron fist has, is that you generally have a fairly stable government. Democracy is messy, and we see that in our own country. Changing from dictatorship to democracy is even messier, especially when you leave before the job is done, you create a power vacuum, and you allow other forces to creep in, which is what we have now. There has been some headway. You know, the Iraqi government has started to kind of stabilize and make some headway against ISIS. And you're seeing the Kurds really step up. And as I said, they pretty much control about a quarter to a third of Iraq. And they're talking about doing referendums to have a free and independent Kurdistan. So the situation in Iraq is definitely messier since when we toppled Saddam Hussein. But it's also very different because the political and cultural landscape of the country is far different than when it was. You know, when we first got rid of Saddam Hussein, it was Shia Sunni. And that was the issue that you had to contend with. But now, you know, the Kurds are a more dominant force. They're actually controlling territory. They're keeping their territory incredibly stable. You still have the Shia-Sunni conflict. And then you've got ISIS as well. So there are more belligerents in the conflict now. But there's pockets of hope. Like when we look at the Kurds, the territory that they control, they're actually keeping relatively peaceful. They're relatively stable. They're forming a government. You know, we're seeing there's glimmers of hope there in the chaos that is ISIS.
Well, that's a more encouraging report about Iraq than I've heard in quite some time. And of course, Barack Obama was blamed for pulling out prematurely, although one has to stipulate that he was faced with a daunting situation given the way things had deteriorated, despite the troop surge that happened late in the Bush presidency, and also with a war that was extremely unpopular among the American people. So those things must be taken into account in terms of Obama's actions in Iraq. But let's before we let you go, I want to talk about Syria a little bit because, you know, Trump bombed one of their air bases early in his administration after the Assad regime employed chemical weapons. But again, we have no real idea what the president's strategy is there other than to than to retaliate for the use of chemical weapons. As best you can describe it, what would you say is our strategy in Syria, and what should it be? Because it has created an enormous refugee crisis, with Europe bearing the brunt of it.
So I hate to tell you this, but as far as what the president's strategy in Syria is, your guess is as good as mine. He's been very quiet about what our strategic goals in Syria are. And most actions that have been taken have been reactionary. You know, you had the cruise missile strike, which we covered extensively on the website. I think we had a whole day dedicated to it.
We did.
But you had the cruise missile strike. You had some conflicts with Russia because there's, you know, opposing goals. Syria's a mess. Syria's a mess, not just because of the refugee crisis, but because it's essentially serving as a proxy war for about, you know, half a dozen different parties. We have some goals and strategic outcomes that we'd like to see that none of us really know because the president hasn't said anything. Russia has some fairly obvious strategic goals that they want to happen. They're a longtime supporter of Assad. They're looking for more strategic footholds in the region. They're getting them. So Russia's kind of getting what they want in Syria. Turkey has some clear goals that they want, mostly dealing with the Kurds. The Kurds have some goals that they want. And then you have the Syrian rebels that have some goals that they want. And you have ISIS that has goals that they want. There's about six or seven different groups within Syria that all have their own goals and outcomes, and they're all fighting against each other. Some of them are frenemies. Some of them are straight allies. The whole country's a mess because it's a proxy war for half a dozen different people.
Do you think it's possible for us to make common ground with Russia in Syria in opposing ISIS? That's only one slice of the rebellion against Assad, and it seems that they are simply taking advantage of the chaos that exists in Syria among the more, I guess I would call them, the internal rebels from within Syria, as opposed to ISIS, which probably includes Syrians but is also drawing members and volunteers from all over the Middle East. Is this an area where we could actually create some common ground with Russia, or is that just wholly unrealistic?
Oh, no, we can absolutely have some common ground, and we do. You know, we're both obviously committed to fighting ISIS, and through our various proxies and through our own forces, we are doing so. The relationship between us and Russia is obviously tenuous. You know, there's some stress there because we support anti-government rebels and they support the government, and there's that area of tension. But at the end of the day, we are both, you know, going after ISIS. So there is some assistance going back and forth there. There is some cooperation. You know, it's very stressful. It's a little hesitant at times. We are operating generally in different parts of the country, but there's definitely some common ground there. The waters are just kind of muddied by some of the opposing strategic goals that we do have.
Okay, Nathan, great information. I've learned a lot. Hopefully those listening to The Uprising have learned a lot too. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today.
Thanks for having me, and keep your powder dry.
Absolutely. We promise we will. Nathan Steelwater, military affairs correspondent on LibertyNation.com. If you didn't hit our site this week, you missed Leftist Madness, Horses and an Asian ESPN Announcer by Tess Lynn, and The Left Takes Over the Charlottesville City Council by our man on the ground in Charlottesville, Jim Capua. Truth is making a comeback at LibertyNation.com. I'm Tim Donner, and this is The Uprising, the podcast of LibertyNation.com.